The Tom Woods Show, episode 721.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey everybody, Tom Woods here talking about money today. And we're talking about money with Philip Bagus, who is a professor of economics in Madrid at the Universidad Rey Juan Carlos. And he is co-author of a brand new book called Blind Robbery, How the Fed, Banks, and Government Steal Our Money. TomWoods.com/721 is where we'll have a link to that for you. It is a book that works for the beginner. In fact, it works for people who aren't even in this circle at all, gets them thinking about important things. But it also can work for the advanced student, because I guarantee you, you're going to find arguments in here you hadn't thought of before against the government fiat money system. So great book and a great guy to talk to. Philip, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be on your show, Tom.
All right, let's talk about blind robbery. Nothing subtle about the title of this book. I want to talk about the ideas in the book, but then toward the end, just because I enjoy having a chance to pick your brain, I do want to ask you a few more advanced questions that aren't covered in the book, just because I want to know the answer, and here you are. But what this is, and as I was telling people in the introduction, is a very useful book for people, first of all, who are new to some of these ideas, but even people who have been around a while, I think, will benefit from this because you present the ideas in ways I haven't necessarily heard presented before and in ways that are very persuasive and that are step by step. Each point builds upon the previous one. So I think it's very, very well done, and it's not a long book, and it doesn't take very long to read. What are you hoping to accomplish? Somebody reads this book. How do you want his thinking changed by the end?
The motivation for the book was that Andreas Marquardt and I thought that probably the most important problem of our times is actually the monetary system. The monetary system, in our view, is the most urgent problem that we have in our societies, in Western societies. Of course, if you ask people, average people on the street, if you ask them what is the most urgent problem, most of them won't say the monetary system. And we wanted to change that. The problem here is, of course, that the monetary system is very complex and very hard to understand. And most people won't go through Mises, the theory of money and credit, or what it is, Soto's money, bank credit and economics cycles. It's very complex and large books. So we thought, if this is a problem, if this is really the most urgent problem, what we have to do is to convince people that something has to be changed in the monetary system, that it's fundamentally flawed. And in order to do this, we must reach many people. We must reach people we haven't reached before. Therefore, we wrote the book. And as you said, we tried to write it in a way that basically anyone can understand it, and also in a provocative way and in a funny way, so people like reading it. It's not a burden or something, but it's actually fun reading it.
I'm going to skip ahead in it. I would say a decent number of people listening know the basic argument about where money comes from and what problems it solves and what form it traditionally takes, things like that. Let's go ahead into something more, a little bit more advanced. You have a chapter on who is allowed to create money and who is not. I think people just assume, even a lot of libertarians who haven't given the question much thought, would assume that money is unlike other commodities. They can see how fish could be sold on the free market, or sneakers, or steak dinners, or whatever. That they can see all that. But money, it doesn't seem obvious how you could sell money or buy money. I buy and sell all these other things. So it is easier for them to be persuaded that some special agency has to supply the money. How are you able to explain in a way that's simple and yet compelling that actually money is not so different as compared to other goods in this regard?
Yeah, we one thing that we use in the book again and again is that we go to a town or a city in the past and explain how money arises through individual action, and then how the state comes in and it's a king and sees there his opportunity to get hand on the monetary system, on the money, to have more income, and manipulates the system in his favor. And then he finds also in another sequence of the story, he finds the banking system as a possible ally and gives the banking system the privilege of producing money in exchange for the banking system buying, financing him, buying his bonds. And this comes very naturally because before we explain how gold is mined by private miners, how it works very well, how this society is built, and then the state comes in and appropriates it, and everything gets messed up.
All right, so I think that's one of the big problems people have with understanding our position on all this. It's hard for them to visualize it, hard for them to understand how it could be that we could survive without a monopoly on the issuance of money. But then there'll be others who say, you know, at least the government or its central bank can carry out monetary policy. It can use money to guide the economy in certain ways. It can help, let's say, bring the economy back from a depression. It can help stimulate the economy by its use of its money monopoly. And this is a good thing, whereas if it were in private hands, heaven knows what would happen. What's wrong with that kind of objection?
Well, this is the fundamental error to think that producing more money would make society richer. And producing more money does not produce more cars or more food or more services. It only... It does not produce any real goods, so society does not get richer, and society does not get out of recession because we produce more money. Well, I mean, we could add a zero to all banknotes and to all bank accounts, and society would not be richer. So, people who think that by producing money or the money monopolist by producing money could make society richer or get society out of recession, actually don't get these basics or just want to use the monetary system for some redistribution, because money production normally also leads to a redistribution in favor of those who receive the new money first. So this seems to me more like an excuse for some redistribution in favor of the government, the banking system, and their friends.
Let's talk about that, because you do make the argument in the book that people are concerned about inequality, but they don't make note of the role of the monetary system in exacerbating inequality. And you point out, for example, this is not the only way that inequality is fostered by the monetary system, but for instance, that there are distribution or Cantillon effects of the when new money is created, it's not distributed evenly across the population. It enters the economy at discrete points, and if you happen to be at one of those discrete points, you get to enjoy the money before prices have risen commensurately, and this gives you a windfall, whereas everyone else is suffering a loss. But on the other hand, and it's true that people who have government contracts or are well connected to the government tend to be the ones getting the new money first. But on the other hand, wouldn't people receiving transfer payments like Social Security and welfare and food stamps, wouldn't they also be getting the new money first? So wouldn't it just be a wash that the poor would also get some new money, so it's about even?
it's of course true that the non-producers that get the transfer payments are also one of the first receivers, tend to be one of the first receivers because they get it directly from the government. So it's totally correct what you say, but I don't think it's totally even, because when the banking system produces the new money, a big part goes to the government. But then we have to think who gets the money from the banks in form of new credits. And there we have to say that someone who owns assets that he can pledge as a collateral in order to get a new loan, in order to get the new money, has an advantage over a person who does not own any asset. So if you own real estate or stocks, you can pledge them as a collateral to get a new loan. But if you are poor and really poor, you don't own real estate, you're just renting it, and you don't own any stocks, then it's very difficult for you to get a loan in normal times. In boom times and bubble times, then you will also get a loan to buy a house, get into problems later. But here the main argument is that if you are rich, the chances are that you will get a higher proportion of the new loans created, of the new money created. If you are a George Soros, for example, you just call the bank, have a good connection to your bank, you just call it and say you want a 1 billion loan to speculate against a currency, for example, and you will get it. But if you are poor, you won't get so much money so easily. Rather, you will see that always new money is created and that prices go up and your bills, your gas bill will get ever higher, and you will probably not understand why. And it's because George Soros gets all the new money.
All right, let's shift gears away from George Soros for a moment. I want to ask you about a complaint that we hear from people like Paul Krugman about the sorts of things you're saying. He would say, of all things in the world to be concerned about right now, price inflation has got to be the absolute lowest. We have a lot of things wrong with the economies of the Western world, but surely price inflation is not one of them. And people who have been concerned about it now look vaguely ridiculous. And yet in your book, you have all kinds of warnings about price inflation. And yet price inflation, even if we acknowledge that maybe the government understates it, and even that I think is overdone a bit, it's still been quite mild at least by 20th century standards. So why worry about it?
Because it could be around the corner. But beside that we, if in the past there hasn't been, in the past few years there haven't been price inflation, that doesn't mean that in the next 5 years there won't be. And of course there has been price inflation, mostly in asset price markets, in the stock market, for example, but also in some countries in the real estate markets. So prices have risen very fast. For example, in Germany, the real estate market has risen very much. But here, the point is actually not how the price level changes in relation to the arguments that we do. The redistribution that is occurring due to the production of the new money occurs independent from the change of the price level. Or to put it in other words, what is important is the change in the money supply. If there's a huge change in the money supply, there's much new money produced, then there's a huge redistribution, even though prices are constant. It could be that there are other factors that compensate for the increase in the money supply, and there have been these factors in the past 30, 40 years, because there has been the globalization. It's basically 1 or 2 billion people have been incorporated in the international division of labor. I mean, China and India were basically did not exist 30 or 40 years ago from the point of view of human action for European or American, because there was no exchange with them. Now suddenly we get 2 billion people more producing goods and services and exchanging with us. The iPhone, the computer you sit on, are probably made in China. 40 years ago, that was not the case. So this, of course, led to a tremendous growth and also a revolution in technology, the internet, information technology, a huge revolution, huge productivity increases. If the money supply would have been constant, probably prices would have fallen 30 or 40%. Or even more. But prices did not fall, but kept rising. So this tells us that there has been a huge increase in the money supply and also a huge redistribution. So the poor maybe did not see prices rise so fast, but they could not enjoy the price fall that would have occurred if the money supply would not have increased and the new money would have been given to the government, to the banks, and to the rich.
Let me ask you something that I hear a lot of confusion about. Suppose we had a gold standard, even just a classical gold standard enforced by the government, and the money supply is then increased by means of gold mining. So there's now more money than there was before, and the introduction of the gold into the economy also occurs at discrete points. So why would that be considered legitimate, let's say from a moral standpoint, but the introduction of fiat money by the government into the economy would be morally suspect? What's the difference?
The difference is that anyone can mine gold, but only the Fed can print dollars. I cannot print dollars, I cannot print euros, but I can go in my garden and mine for gold or buy some land in Africa to mine for gold. So from a moral point of view, it's the monopoly of the money production that is the problem in fiat money. The monopoly for base money production is at the Fed or at the ECB, and then they have this kind of franchise where they give also the banking system the privilege to produce money substitutes. While within a gold standard, everyone can try to find and mine gold, and this normally has also a very high cost, while, of course, the production of fiat money is virtually nil in the case of electronic money and in the case of paper money, also very low. So these are the differences.
And of course, the production of gold in that case would be taking place within the realm of economic calculation and profit and loss. And so you would know there would be a natural point where the most profitable thing to do in the world would not be to mine additional gold. Whereas with fiat money produced by the government, not only is there no profit and loss feedback, but of course it's pretty much costless to create the money. So there are no constraints on money creation, whereas the constraints under a gold standard would be the constraints of the marketplace, the constraints of scarcity and competition for resources, and doesn't make sense to pour all resources into the production of gold. Now, what about the effects on the overall economy of an injection of fiat money into the system and an increase in gold mining? How is it different? Like, for instance, is the business cycle created? This, I get this a lot. Is there a business cycle simply because there's more gold in the economy now?
Yeah, that is a good question. Also, in the case of fiat money, the new money is normally introduced through the credit market, the loan market. So the new money is produced by the banking system, introduced into the loan market, and this lowers the interest rate artificially below the rate it would otherwise have. While in the case of in a gold standard, gold production, the new money goes first to the miners, and then whatever they buy with the gold. But we cannot suppose that it changes actually the interest rate, that it manipulates, changes the interest rate, because the new money, the new gold, does not go into the loan market, but it just goes to the owner of the gold mine, and then he buys, I don't know, a car or a house, so the price of the car goes up or the price of the house goes up, while in the case of fiat money, the new money goes through the loan market and there falsifies the most or manipulates the most important price in the economy, that is the interest rate, that is very important for the coordination between saving and consumption.
All right, now let me ask you something a little bit more technical, if I may. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about, I don't expect you to be an economic historian of the U.S., but I know you know about the debate between, the way Rothbard looked at the Great Depression and the way somebody like Milton Friedman looked at it. But sometimes they'll throw Hayek in your face and they'll say, Even Hayek would say, and by the way, I'm thinking of that great article that you wrote years ago. Gosh, I hope that was you. I'm going to be embarrassed if it was somebody else, where you critiqued all the Austrian economists for their deviationist views on deflation. Was that your article?
Yes.
Okay, oh, thank goodness. Okay, I feel better. But and I'm sure, I don't remember it well enough, I'm sure you had plenty to say about Hayek, but he said, look, I'm not in favor of inflation, but I'm not in favor of deflation either. And at some point, you know, I mean, he seemed to leave open room for the monetary authority to intervene in certain cases. Can you elaborate on that and explain what would be wrong with that?
Yes, I mean, this is not only Hayek. Many free market economists think that after an artificial boom, when then the bust comes and the credit contraction, there's some place for the government or the central bank to be in order to prevent a credit contraction to run its full course, because it could... it could bring down the whole banking system, and through a severe price deflation, it could cause many bankruptcies in the economy, because it gets, when prices fall, it gets ever more difficult to service your debt that is nominally fixed. So when there has been a long boom and prices have risen many years and people have gotten very indebted, if then a credit contraction comes and prices fall very much, then debtors will not be able to service their debt, and then they cannot pay back their loans. Then the banking system will go belly up, and there will be a huge depression. And this is what Hayek thought. In this case, it would be okay if the government or the central bank would intervene and stop prices to fall and stops the credit contraction. Well, Rothbard looks more positively on this scenario, and I agree with him that it, for moral reasons, of course, it should be. It's better that the credit contraction runs its course, and also for economic reasons, because malinvestments are purged much faster if prices are allowed to fall. And it's true that there will be more bankruptcies, but hey, who knows what is the optimum amount of bankruptcies in an economy? Does Hayek know it? No. Does I know it? No, I don't know it either. The optimal amount is the one that where private property rights are respected, and when people cannot service their debts, then they go bankrupt, and that's it. And then there's just a redistribution.
Yeah. So let me jump in and explain. Make sure everybody's following this. The point is that even if some firms go under and they go bankrupt, there's no reason this has to be a disrupting force in the economy, because the physical stuff they own still exists. It simply gets transferred to different owners in bankruptcy courts. So that's what we mean by there's just a redistribution. The assets now get placed into, we presume to be, more capable hands. But what about the objection that, and I know George Riesman has said this and a few other people, that bankruptcy courts tend to move very slowly, so maybe this process would be slow and agonizing, and it wouldn't be as pleasant as you suggest when you say, oh, it would just be a bunch of redistributions. But if it's held up in the courts forever, then it, maybe it would drag everything down.
Yeah, I mean, if of course there will be a pressure to privatize the court system so that it will be faster. Of course the government court system is very slow. So this is actually an argument to privatize justice and the court system, because then it will be faster. But even if it takes some time to sort it out, if you think of the company, let's say the company goes only bankrupt because it has debts and prices have fallen and the owner cannot service the debts. And we assume that the business model is actually a good one. It's actually viable. And the company goes only bankrupt because of the price deflation. Of course, the new owner then will continue to run the company. And it's also in the interest of the old owner to continue to run the company. And if we think that now there's a time between a time that the court needs to sort it out, it's in the interest of both that that this company, which business model is actually viable, continues to produce. So it's not in the interest of anyone to stop the production if the business model is viable. But of course there will be some frictions. But then again, in any bankruptcy there's a friction. And who is to say which amount of bankruptcy is optimal? In the free market, we will see what is the optimal amount of bankruptcy. No one can know.
You know, you remind me of Guido Holzmann, in that you have this ability to say things.
Because of the German accent.
Well, I was going to say it's not quite so superficial, but it's that maybe that accent allows you to get away with saying things that would shock most people, and you say them matter-of-factly. You know, as if you're listing the ingredients in a lasagna recipe or something. All right, let's skip ahead to your chapter on where this all ends, how this all ends. Is it necessarily the case? Doesn't it seem to be overstated to say that fiat money systems have to end badly, that they can't possibly be managed well? Is there a way, could you envision the present system in the Western world at least continuing in perpetuity? Or if not, why not?
I can see it to continue in perpetuity. I think this actually depends on the ideas that people have. If people accept the system as it is, that we have fiat money, a money monopoly by the government, then it can continue basically forever. But if people change their opinion, and I hope our book contributes to that, it can't. How could they do it to continue with this system? It looks like we are going to a dead end because we have so high debts. The governments all over the world are over-indebted. Interest rate, central banks have had to lower interest rates, very low, even to negative rates. It does not seem that they could raise the rates again, because if they raise the rates to normal levels, the government will go bankrupt, the banking system. So it looks like they have to continue to print and print and print. But there are many ways how they could continue in the system, reducing the over-indebtedness. They could do, I list several options. One of them is to do a one-time wealth tax and to use this money to pay down debts of governments and the banking system. There could be a bail-in in the banking system. Let me explain a bail-in. A bail-in is when the creditors of the banks are bailed into the bank. That is, they are changed into shareholders. So instead of owning a bond that was issued by a bank, then you get a shareholder. That means the bank has less debts and more equity. And in this way, the banking system gets recapitalized and could stand bankruptcies or even a haircut on government bonds. Or you can have a full-fledged monetary reform. You can have a paper money that is basically at the end. For example, this happened after the Second World War in Germany. The old Reichsmark was basically useless. It was a paper money at its end. But they did a monetary reform that were designed in a way that another paper money could be introduced, the Deutsche Mark. How did they do that? Basically, they wrote down all government debts. They wrote down by one-tenth. They wrote down all monetary assets. They taxed away all profits that arose in this reform. When debts, for companies, when the debts were reduced to one-tenth, this meant one-time profits, windfall profits for them, which were taxed away over 20 years, I think, completely. And the banks were actually recapitalized because their government bonds were not written down, but they were given new government bonds. So at the end of all these measures combined, we had the result that the government were without debts, the German governments. The banking system was recapitalized, over-indebtedness was reduced, well, enslavers were basically expropriated. But the system was then on stable grounds again. From there on, the system could work again. It was like pushing the reset button on a computer. And this is what they probably, if things get very ugly, they will try to do it again. And it is possible that when the fiat money is running against the wall, to do a monetary reform, which is like pushing a reset button and start all over again. Of course, it implies huge losses for the savers and the money users, but then they can try to start all over again. So it can continue in perpetuity. It depends if people let them get away with it.
Well, Philip, I want to recommend your book to the audience, Blind Robbery, How the Fed, Banks, and Governments Steal Our Money. It is available, of course, from all the usual places, Amazon, and I'm going to link to it at tomwoods.com/721. It has a very persuasive blurb on the back cover by a certain podcast host my listeners may be familiar with. It is like a bucket of ice water over your head, this book. But it's ice water that makes you smarter while it's hitting you. So I'm glad you did it, and I'm glad we're able to have this conversation, and I hope people will grab one, and best of luck. Thank you.
I thank you, Tom.
All right, a couple things to tell you. Remember I mentioned on an episode maybe a week ago, I said I've got a debate coming up that is so juicy, you're just going to forget all other debates you've ever heard of or seen. Well, I think I've got that lined up, but it's going to be another couple of weeks because one of the people involved is, get this, moving. And I'm very, very sympathetic to this person in that situation. But that juicy debate is coming. I've been talking a lot about websites that my listeners have been starting. And a lot of them are libertarian blogs, and that is terrific. But, once in a while I'm getting a site that has nothing to do with libertarianism. It's just some useful site where you learn something about some other sort of topic. And here's an example. Coach Speak. The website is coachspeakshow.com. And Coach Speak, this is right on the About page, is a talent development company that primarily serves coaches and those who want to become coaches. So you'll find with their podcast interviews from athletic directors, compliance officials, agents, coaches from many sports and levels, each giving valuable insights on the journey to become a successful head coach. It's also offers a professional development program to help you improve your communication skills and influence. It says we can help you identify your behaviors plus the behaviors of others and use that information to become a more effective and efficient communicator. So if this speaks to you, this is an area that interests you, then definitely check out coachspeakshow.com, and we'll link to that at tomwoods.com/721 as the listener website mentioned. Remember, you can get this kind of shout-out and all kinds of free bonuses, plus an exclusive mastermind group for bloggers, just by checking out tomwoods.com/publicity before you start your site. Tomorrow, we're talking about cars again with our old friend Eric Peters. We're going to be talking about Tesla, what's going on there. We got cars that are bursting into flames. That's a bit of a problem. I'm going to ask him about radar detectors, by the way. I got stopped the other day. I didn't get a ticket, thank goodness, but I got stopped. Every time I get stopped, I do a search on Google for a good radar detector, then I never wind up buying one. He's going to tell us what the best one is, what he uses. It's going to be all kinds of great insights. Because, who wants to give the government extra money, right? You can always mail them a check if you really want to, but I, for one, don't. But anyway, it's going to be a lot of fun, a lot of different stories about what's going on in the world of cars and liberty. So definitely do not miss the car episodes, even if you're not a car. I'm not particularly a car person. I'm not that interested in cars, but I drive one, and I'm interested in libertarianism, and Eric Peters is just the guy to bring those two things together. So make sure and tune in for that episode number 722, and thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.